We're going to call the meeting to order at this time, and Senator Latz has entered the room, and we'll start with Senate File 1151. Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. This is Senate File 1151, which is a bill to support the 9/11 emergency telecommunications effort in the state of Minnesota. This is a system that was built out in the metro area hasn't been built out yet in all of the state. There are some pockets around the state that already have it, some major areas that do, but a lot of the system is not built out effectively in the rest of the state. And this is a bill that would accomplish the final build-out and then some, hopefully some technology upgrades in the metro area so that the entire system can all talk to itself. So I'd like to ask Assistant Commissioner Leslie to make some remarks, and I also have Ron Whitehead here, both with the Department of Public Safety.
Okay, Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Tim Leslie, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety, and I just want to let you know this is a very important initiative for us at the Department of Public Safety. As we've traveled the state, this has been the number one priority for our partners in law enforcement, the fire service, and emergency medical services. But it goes beyond that. It's an interoperability system that will allow us to tie in with those first responders, but it goes beyond that as well. It also allows bus companies, school districts, and others to tie into the system also. I chair the statewide radio board, and that's a board of 21 representatives from across the state that get together and talk about the planning and the policy implications for this as we build it out. And I know just enough to be dangerous. So at that point, I think I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Whitehead, who's going to tell you more about this initiative.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Whitehead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Whitehead. I'm the Armor 911 Program Director in the Department of Public Safety. I'll give you just a little bit of my background. I retired as the Deputy Chief from Bloomington, Minnesota, which is a bit unique in the fact that we took a perfectly serviceable radio system in Bloomington and ultimately went to this Armor system because of the need for interoperability and the importance of interoperability. I'll give you a little history on the project, and in deference to your time constraints, I'll try to make it brief in that respect. And I'll also make mention that we do have some people here representing the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, Sheriff Bud Olson, Mike Goldstein representing the Minnesota Chiefs of the Police Association, Buck McAlpine representing the Minnesota Ambulance Association, and they're certainly prepared to give you additional testimony on the need for this system and the need to carry it statewide. The Armor system started out back in 1995 when the legislature authorized the Metropolitan Radio Board to be created, a political subdivision in the metropolitan area, to plan for interoperability, to provide a interoperable communications throughout the nine-county metropolitan area at that particular point in time. And in 1997 is the first time that the 911 fee was used as a source of funding, when 4 cents of the 911 fee was authorized to pay for revenue bonds and to pay for improvements or implementing of the system in the nine-county metropolitan area. That system was ultimately implemented in 2001. And at that same time, the legislature called for the Department of Transportation to prepare a report for the legislature upon interoperable communications. And what I may make mention of the fact is that we're undergoing a technology transition, a need to renew the wireless infrastructure in the state of Minnesota, not unique to the state of Minnesota, but really a national issue, not only caused by 911, but also caused by technology. Most public safety communication systems were implemented back in the 60s and 70s. In fact, interestingly, there was some discussion just occurring about the first wireless communication systems implemented in 1937 in the state of Minnesota. Just recent was the Sheriff Olson had found some old notes on that. And then in the 1950s and 60s, we implemented the VHF systems of today. We're undergoing a similar transition from high band frequency to VHF frequency and now into the 800 frequency with our need for advanced for continued interoperability. But anyway, I will get back to the fact that the legislature accepted a report in 2001 from the Department of Transportation. As part of that study, the Department of Transportation surveyed all of public safety. And when I say public safety, I'm, as the assistant commissioner said, public safety in terms of the FCC is really government. It can be school buses, schools. It can be any governmental entity is considered to be part of the public safety spectrum. We routinely consider that to be police, fire, an ambulance, but this is really a governmental communication system providing the opportunity to make sure that people can talk, everybody can talk that needs to. In 2001, the report was submitted to the legislature. The legislature then said create a planning committee to implement this plan, and subsequently came back in 2002 with a planning committee report that recommended a phased implementation of the system. That, at that point, the plan called for implementation in phase three in 2002, phase four in 2003, phase five in 2004, and phase six in 2005. In other words, completing the system sometime in 2007. Unfortunately, at that particular point in time, it didn't get funded. In fact, in 2003, there was some funding, but because of some issues in the 911 fund, we were not able to proceed. And it wasn't until 2005 that the legislature authorized additional 911 fees to be used to finance phase three of the implementation process. And the Department of Transportation is currently in the process of implementing phase three in 23 counties outside the metropolitan area. That will carry the system out to through central Minnesota, out to the South Dakota border, and then in southeastern Minnesota, in the southeastern corner there, anchoring both the Rochester area and the St. Cloud area. And that's currently in the process of being implemented throughout the state. With that legislation, they also provided for some funding for local enhancement costs for the cost of local communities to put additional coverage or capacity needs. With respect to the plan. Since, as I've indicated, there is no funding at the present time for phase four, five, and six, and yet what we have is the need to replace our wireless communications in this state. Most systems are aging. The technology has changed from analog to digital. Things have moved from trunking to conventional. And the FCC mandate of narrow banding, in other words, really creating the obsolescence of all our old communication system by 2013. And with that, the governor has made a recommendation that we build this system and get it done by 2012. And that's what we're really talking about. Senate File 1151 is a recommendation that we proceed with the building of the radio system. We get it built out, get it in place by 2012 so that it's available as an alternative for a number of counties outside the metropolitan area, and so that we do it in a coordinated fashion. As part of that study that was done by the Department of Transportation, they indicated that if everybody replaces their radio systems separately, the cost will be somewhere in the area of $1.4 billion for all the local governments. If we do that on a shared platform, we can do it at a much less cost to the local governments. The cost of the state will be approximately the same, but the cost to local governments if we use a shared platform will be much less. And in addition to that, if we do it on a common platform, we create interoperability at the highest level. In other words, seamless interoperability amongst our public safety officials so that they can talk throughout the state if they need to. I'll go over just briefly what's included in 1151, in Senate File 1151, and that is essentially the fact that it does provide for the construction of the backbone throughout the state by 2012. It provides funding for an upgrade that's necessary in the metropolitan area because we've gone 6 years in the metropolitan area. The platform that's exists in phase three has been upgraded as an upgraded version, and we need to upgrade the metropolitan area to make sure that we've got seamless interoperability. It provides funding for a detailed design plan to transition from a conceptual plan to a detailed design, provides money immediately for the Department of Transportation to do site identification and start some of the civil work that's necessary to get antenna sites in place. And then finally provides for the operating costs. And that's one of the key features as we've moved across the state is everybody's asked, what's it going to cost us to be on the system? As part of this recommendation is we're going to fund the operation of the system. There will be no operating costs to local communities that operate on the backbone itself. There will be, they may in fact have to pay for some of the costs of their local enhancements, pieces they put in. But as far as the backbone goes, we'll be paying the operating costs if Senate File 1151 passes. Finally, it accomplishes that with a bonding authority of $62 million each year in fiscal year 2009, fiscal year 2010, fiscal year 2011, allows us to proceed with the implementation of the backbone and work with all the local communities to get this in place. How do we do that? It calls for a 10-cent increase in the 911 fee in fiscal year 2009, 10 cents in 2010, 10 cents in 2020 for a total of 30 cents. That would place the 911 fee at 95 cents per access line. What I have provided you and I think has been distributed is a summary of where we would, what would that do, where would that put the state of Minnesota. Right now we're in the lower, our fee, the 65 cent fee, puts us in the lower middle of the various states. It would raise us up into the higher range, but still not the highest. There's about 10 states that are higher than us when you look at the combined wireless and wireline fee. As I previously said, we do have some additional people here that are available to answer some questions, or first, I guess I should stop and allow the chair or the committee to ask any questions if they may, that they may have.
So, Mr. Whitehead, are these current charges or it's what's projected charges?
The front sheet is at 65 cents, so that's the current. That's where we are amongst the 50 states in the current charge. And the second sheet is if you did it with the 95 cents, so it's where we move in the if it goes to 95 cents.
And I'm afraid I wasn't following you real closely, but it seems to me that you were saying that there really aren't any gaps in services, but this would integrate current systems. Is that correct? And it would increase the sophistication of the services or the equipment or the infrastructure?
Madam Chair, I believe right now the backbone is in the metropolitan area. That was completed in 2001. It's being built in phase three. There are 55 counties that are relying on their old systems that have to be replaced by 2013. So this would provide the backbone for 55 counties in the remainder of the state as one alternative for their public safety communications.
And then, Madam Chair, it would upgrade the metropolitan system as well for the new technology that's come online since 2001.
Okay. Senator Senjum, do you have any questions?
Madam Chair, I did have one. How long have we been at 65? That was fairly recent legislation, wasn't it?
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, you're right. That was 2 years ago we raised it to 25 cents.
And so, Madam Chair, my question, did not we realize in 2005 in 2005, did 65 cents seem adequate? Has there been new information or new challenges that have confronted this project that now necessitate this additional money?
Mr.
Obviously,
White,
there has, I guess.
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, at that particular point in time, phase four was the only phase that was being funded, and we were still operating on a phased approach. What we're saying now is that the deadlines, because we've delayed so long, the deadlines, it will take us 2012 to get it in place, and January 1st of 2013 is when many of these existing systems have to be replaced.
I'd like to indicate that a quorum has checked in at this point. Any further comments or questions, Senator Senjum?
Madam Chair and Mr. Whitehead, although we have these bonds to pay off, and that's probably a 15 to 20 year phenomena, I suppose. But could we assume at some point that maybe we could come off this level of fee and get into a more of a maintenance fee?
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, you're correct in that. Actually, the most recent bonds, we have sold bonds for phase three. They were 11-year bonds because we provided adequate reserves for that. The norm would probably be 15-year bonds, and after that, yes, I would expect that the fee may be reduced.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify either in favor or against the bill? Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm Sheriff Bud Olson from Carver County and the first sheriff in the state to go online with this 800 trunk radio system. My county was experiencing a situation where we had very old and antiquated system, and we did a study to see what the cost of trying to build our system versus putting in or joining this system. And my county board went ahead and funded much of the cost of this on their own to get us up and running in Carver County. It also included all the fire departments in my county, as well as the emergency and risk management department in my county, as well as our public services. One of the really good features of this system is its flexibility and its interoperability. I'll just explain one experience that I had. In 2005, I had a suspected bomb, a package in a school in my county, and we had to ask for resources outside the county to assist us. And through our interoperability and our ability to communicate with each other, we were able to do this very large event in my county. It actually closed a public school for 3 days, if you can remember that, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So this is one of those issues that is so important to public safety statewide. I have a sheriff, and I am representing the Sheriff's Association from Itasca County, Pat Maduri. He was a big skeptic with me. He sat on the state board and was very skeptical about wanting to join this project. But now today, if he was here to testify, he will tell you that he is fully committed to it. And locally, they are I think the number he'll tell you is $9.4 million that their local taxpayers will also be applying to this project. And he is moving ahead in the outstate region as well. So the need is there. The need is great. It gives us that flexibility and that opportunity when sheriffs really need to make a decision on their radio system. This could be there for them. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Oh, would you also state your name for the record?
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Mike Goldstein. I'm the Plymouth Police Chief, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. As a user of the interoperable system, I'm here to talk about its success. However, before I do so, I'd like to share an opportunity or an experience that I had a few years back. After 9/11, I had an opportunity to attend a three-day after-action report on the attack on the Pentagon in Arlington, Virginia. While I learned many important lessons from their experience, one issue was clear. Within seconds after the building was struck, emergency responders put their response plans into action using an interoperable radio system. Unlike public safety officials in New York City who did not have the luxury of an interoperable or integrated radio system, the emergency responders from dozens of local, state, and federal agencies within the D.C. metro area were able to communicate and carry out their mission. Whether it be a large traffic crash, a SWAT call-out, a large fire or hazardous materials incident, or the extraordinary terrorist event, which none of us are immune from, an interoperable system is critical and crucial. I can tell you from firsthand experience when I did not have this system in place or available to me how cumbersome it was to manage a large emergency or disaster, whereas I can also tell you, now having this system in place, how effective this system is. Case in point, several years back in 1998, I was involved in a shooting where we had 11 different agencies respond. I was managing the scene on one channel, and if please take my word how cumbersome it was to manage that incident with all of the responders. On the flip side, a couple of years ago at one of our high schools, we carried out an exercise where we had 13 different agencies working involving helicopters, EMS, fire, public safety, emergency management, etc., to work on a major incident at a school to see how effective our response plans were. And to have this system in place for that event made all the difference in the world. We were able to segregate different talk groups and keep people separated so that they could communicate clearly with one another and carry out their objectives. The completion of the Armor Project is a top priority for the state chiefs, the police association, because in the end, the public is going to ask, how many more examples do we need to tell us, why can't you talk to one another when bad things happen? So this is a system that works in the metro area and in other parts of the state, and it's something that we as the State Chiefs Association would like to see all of us take advantage of throughout the state of Minnesota to keep our public safe. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments? Senator Jungbar.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm just going to make a quick comment because we always hear this kind of good testimony, but I can give you a firsthand experience as a mayor of East Bethel when we had what we called the Carlos Edge Fire. It was a huge fire that multiple fire departments were working on and the DNR because of their swamp rigs and things, and we could not communicate as fire professionals with the DNR, so we had no idea where they were at any given time. So it also works across other situations other than what law enforcement's talking about. It's extremely important.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Jungbar, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair.
So Senator Jungbar moves that Senate File 1151 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any question? Any comments? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Let's see. I'm going to call on Senator Saxhog next. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, today I'm presenting Senate File 477. This bill would appropriate $400,000 for a feasibility study for a plasma gasification plant that we're trying to build in International Falls. With me today are Steve Korstad and John Howard to give a very brief presentation and answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you, Senator. And who's going to speak first?
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity. My name's John Howard, and the company is Coronal. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you so much for the opportunity once again. To be very brief here, we have an opportunity to do something to lead the nation in renewable energy in the form of the conversion of waste to energy. You should have in front of you our presentation. I'll walk you just through a couple of brief points here. The Minnesota waste profile is projected in 2011 to be approximately 7 million tons annually. Of that 7 million tons, the hope is to recycle 50% of that and also to put into the ground, if you will, landfilling 15%. The area in which we, with this plasma gasification project, will be most effective is the waste-to-energy segment, where we hope to increase the waste-to-energy capabilities of the state from 20% to approximately 35%. Now, these numbers are made by the Minnesota Pollution Control. Their projections is where we're getting this data from. What's also significant about that that first chart is this is going to be accomplished by 2011. And so just to bring that to your attention. If you will, the system overview will afford this solution to do some really unique things that the existing waste-to-energy infrastructure within the state of Minnesota does not have the capability of handling.
Is this set up on the screen?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
You
were given the presentation?
We do have it, yes. Okay. I just thought maybe you also had it on the screen.
Sorry, not this time. Madam Chair. The waste-to-energy facility will have the ability to increase overall recycling. The gasification process is unique and different from incineration from the perspective we operate in an oxygen-starved environment. Specifically meaning, and this is real key, burning is a bad thing. We gasify. And at the end of the day, if we don't impart anything else to the committee, understand that we are different from incineration. We don't burn. The significance of that is that we make fewer dioxins and furans, which are pollutants. And so at the end of the day, we have a solution that has the capability of removing waste from the existing waste infrastructure within the state of Minnesota, do it in an economically viable way, in an environmentally sound way, and will enhance the overall waste-to-energy renewable portfolio for the state of Minnesota. I will go offline to really take questions. I'd rather have you guys ask us if there are any questions. The team is available to give more detailed one-on-one information if needed. And so I'd like to introduce my partner, Steve Korstad.
Mr. Korstad?
Open for questions, Ms. Madam Chair.
Are there questions from the committee members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Sachsauger, some of your testifiers. What do you think the outlook for landfills would be over the next 10 years in the state of Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Senator.
Mr. Korstad.
The Pollution Control Agency has determined in their strategic plan that there's only about 15 years left of our landfill capacity in the state. We are filling it up at a rate of 2.3 million tons a year. So we're down to 21 landfills in the state. So it is a short period, short fuse there. Up in northern Minnesota, where the project is going to be, there's really only two landfills left up there.
Any other questions or comments? Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify either for or against the bill? Is there anyone that would like to move the bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sparks.
I would be willing to move Senate File 477.
Okay, Senator Sparks recommends that Senate File 477 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. And we have neither Senator Anderson or Kubley here. Wondering if the page will. Yes. We'll take about a 2-minute break here.
Hey, Dave.
Hello.
Jack's ready to begin. Well, that's bad news.
I think not here. It's kill them.
It's interesting. We're getting our committees are starting to stand.
Yeah.
We'll call the meeting back to order, and Senator Kubley is here at this time. And Senator Kubley, you want to start with Senate File 480?
That's fine, Madam Chair. Senate File 480 is a second-generation biofuels bill. It has several different parts, Madam Chair and members. There is a bioenergy production portion that has an incentive for some technology kinds of issues that are currently available. The second piece that deals with the production of a cellulosic biofuel, specifically ethanol, I think we're a ways off from that yet, a couple years or so anyway. Then there's a section of it that deals with the RIM program here in the state. And finally, there's one for some loans for capital equipment in order to go into the production of cellulosic materials for this purpose. Just to kick it off, Madam Chair, and I know we have some time constraints today. The first portion that deals with the bioenergy production is an intent to harness the immediate heat and power market for bioenergy crops to develop a regular supply of raw cellulosic materials to offset existing fossil fuel use. And it comes, the payments that are connected here are in a couple of tiers, as they are in the production of the fuels as well. But the tiers would be 75 cents per million BTUs for 3 years to a facility that is converting any cellulosic material from an agricultural land to heat or power. And it's to utilize near-term available raw materials of a cellulosic nature. And as I mentioned a bit ago, that material is readily available. Well, apparently there's a handout here too, Madam Chair, that I thought the committee probably already had that. But then the second tier is looks at a payment of $1.50 per million BTUs for a longer period of time for converting any cellulosic material that meets the clean energy standards for production with the RIM lands, and that would be really, a blend of prairie grasses, is my understanding, that, some considerable research has been done on that in the production of biofuels with the University of Minnesota. But it's really to facilitate the early use in existing heat and power market for perennial native materials that can provide clean energy and a lot of other public benefits that I'm sure that this committee would agree with too, Madam Chair. Well, moving on to the biofuel section, deals with the actual production of ethanol, what I've called a second generation production of ethanol from cellulosic materials once again. But here we're looking at meeting one quarter of the existing renewable fuel standard that is derived from the cellulosic material, there would be some limits on how much production, a plant could receive a producer payment for under this model as well. The cellulosic biofuel has, again, two tiers. It's 15 cents a gallon for 5 years to a facility that converts the cellulosic raw material from ag land into a transportation fuel from any cellulosic source. And then the blend of prairie grasses, once again, would get a higher payment. And I think the primary reason that we're looking at giving a higher producer payment for the perennial grasses is the negative carbon, the structure of the perennial plants allows for carbon sequestration and it's actually, you know, a negative carbon producer. So you're actually sequestering more carbon than is released into the atmosphere in the whole process. And that seems to be an important piece at this point in our time and societal structure. So I think that it would give us that piece as well. But it also provides the opportunity to produce a crop that has a value for our society on soils that are not very suitable for the growth of other crops. So, you know, it seems to me that there are a number of benefits here. It would sequester carbon in some rather marginal soils, but it would allow you to use a blend of native and perennial grasses that that produces, according to Drs. Tillman and Hill, and the research that they've done at the U gives us about 2.5 times more ethanol per acre than just corn-based ethanol production. And to me, that's another reason to give this increased producer payment to the ones that are using the materials that give you that increased production. Don Arnasty, I believe, is here. He'll tell you a little bit about the RIM program. But just to mention the fourth area, the clean energy capital investment loans, it does allow you to get into the machinery that would, or to make modifications to your existing equipment that would allow you to harvest this cellulosic material over the long haul, too. And so, you know, it's really an attempt, Madam Chair and members, to get this second-generation stage of ethanol production kind of kicked off in the state of Minnesota and ensure that those plants will be built in the state of Minnesota. Although, you know, I do know there isn't anything in the language of the bill that would prevent a contiguous county. You'll notice that language in the bill, but a contiguous county does not necessarily have to be in the state of Minnesota. So, you know, one of our producers could live in a border state, but you would still be building a plant within the borders of the state. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Arnasty to talk a little bit about the RIM section.
Mr. Arnasty.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Don Arnasty. I work for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, which is a nonprofit policy research and think tank. And I'm representing Clean Energy Minnesota, which is a coalition of 13 different conservation and agricultural organizations, which have pulled together the basis of this policy that Senator Kubley is offering. I understand your time is very limited, so I will keep my remarks brief. But what I would like to help you focus on is what we are trying to establish with this bill is a policy framework that we believe will provide incentives so the next generation of biofuels maximizes benefits to the public. And these benefits can come at a variety of levels, everything from local employment and local circulation of funds. As you notice, some of the incentives that are proposed in the bill are restricted to locally owned facilities. So we're trying to address some of the local economic development needs and the ability to return some of the profits from this emerging energy sector into our local communities. The second thing that we're focusing on is we're establishing a tier of incentives. This is all voluntary, and the whole thing is designed for both facilities that create energy or farmers, and I'll get into the RIM program in just a minute, farmers that would like to participate in the RIM program. It's all voluntary, and they would sign up for a level of performance, a level of commitment. And we're proposing that there be higher incentives given to people who are ready to return more benefits. Now, to focus specifically on Section 4 in the bill, as Senator Kubley mentioned, which is this so-called RIM program, or RIM Renewable Energy, we're trying to establish a new way of working in partnership with our farmers. If I can generally summarize, we have a federal farm bill that is very strong in supporting commodity production and commodity agriculture. And there's also a title there, which the state is involved with through our RIM program, in conservation set-asides. And so what we have is either very strong production focus or a very strong protection focus. What we're proposing with this new RIM category is to accomplish both those objectives on the same piece of ground. You might call it working agricultural land that would provide a renewable energy crop, but do it within standards that would be protective of water quality and wildlife habitat, both of which are strong public interests and that we have issues in this state that we'd like to address. What has been proposed in this bill is $20 million in bonding, which, frankly, we are expecting next year, not this year. We're putting it out here to help indicate what we think is an appropriate pilot scale rollout of this. We would need this year the authorization of this policy framework so the technical committee could work over the summer and into the fall to work out the details of the easements or the agreements that would be signed with the farmers. And this is a stakeholder type process that would involve agricultural interests, farmers, conservation interests, and state government as well, to come with what we believe would be a tiered type incentive program, much like the Conservation Security Program, which is a federal farm bill program right now, where farmers can sign up in under that federal program for one of three levels of reward or payment. And that's based on the level of performance or the amount of public benefit that they're willing to return on their management of farmlands. We think that's a good framework that we're trying to mimic here. What's so important about passing it this year, we believe, is that while what Minnesota can do and can certainly afford to do in terms of easements, we realize is very limited given the current budget situation and all of that, but the federal farm program, which is the big kahuna, where, you know, money is spent and landscapes change, now is an excellent window of opportunity for Minnesota to put out the model of community ownership, public benefits, and a working agricultural lands program that we can then pass into law and take place and move to Washington. And right now our Senate Ag Chair, Senator Vickerman, has been in dialogue, has already written letters to Representative Colin Peterson and other members of the Ag Committee on both the House and Senate side, and trying to say we have ideas here in Minnesota that should help shape the federal debate and the federal funding decision. And so there's an opportunity here. If we can get this pilot program in place, even though it's a very small footprint, it's something that could help shape the federal program that then could be a major funding source and help us bring federal dollars and a renewable fuel industry to the state in a manner that we believe is conducive to maximum public benefit. That's a broad overview. I'd be happy to answer any specific questions, but I don't want to take a lot of the committee's time. Thank you very much.
Senator Chungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess to either one of you, I'm a little concerned that this whole bill deals with cellulosic as it's not really proven totally or ready, I don't believe, based on all the research I've read on it, for commercial production. Why aren't we allowing it open for a lot of other technologies that are in more commercially readily available in terms of biodiesel? I see nothing here for, you know, alternative biodiesels. There's a lot of research that's going to go on, and I think you'll see some companies ready for production of algae to biodiesel and algae to ethanol this summer. There's no incentives for anything like that. We know that second generation, when you're talking to high temperature, this high temperature catalytic conversion of to ethanol or to biodiesel, I'd like to see something open for all of it. I don't think it should be just closed to cellulosic. We know even in terms of ethanol, when you're talking production rates or you know, anything with a sugar base, you have a much higher rate of return than what you'll get out of cellulosic, probably 3.6 as opposed to 2. Whatever you're talking in terms of cellulosic. So it's it holds more promise for the future in terms of not having to subsidize it down the road to get it. You know, I agree we need to steer the ship. We need to get it going that way. But I'm really disappointed that this is only geared towards cellulosic development.
Mr. Arnasty.
Madam Chair and Senator Jungbauer, thank you for raising that. Our intention is very much to work with both what I like to describe as past technology, which is direct burn, conversion of all kinds of materials, whether it's agricultural byproduct, algae, grasses, switchgrass, you name it, to energy. That's a past technology, direct burn. A present technology, as I like to refer to it, which is a gasification platform that, again, is adaptable to all sorts of feedstocks, as Senator Jungbauer points out, or the future emerging technology, which is the development of liquid biofuels, perhaps with enzymes, perhaps through a gasification platform. We have attempted to craft the incentives in here, and there are several different incentives here, designed to be available to all of those research opportunities. So we are trying to be technology neutral and trying to encourage the innovators that are working on some of the systems that Senator Jungbauer is talking about. And by our read, actually, what you're referring to would qualify for some of the incentives in this bill. And if they don't, we'd be very happy to talk about that and to change it. The intention really is to draw the innovators and to draw some of the research folks here and to help them through the early adapter phases so that Minnesota becomes the center of innovation. We already have a lot of research going on at the University of Minnesota, and we'd like to capitalize on that and as you mentioned, steer the direction of the industry towards maximum public benefit.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess we can refer specifically. And I did look through the language, and it did look like some of them would open it up, but specifically if we look at line 1.14, we're talking about persons using native perennial cropping systems for energy or seed production in the capital equipment loan. So I'd like to see those kind of things expanded. So I'm hoping, I'm assuming this has to go to several more committees, and we could maybe expand some of those things.
Mr. Arnasty.
Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer, yes, that particular one, because, again, we have limited funds, we're trying to focus the capital equipment loans on the production systems in the field as opposed to, for instance, algae. But I don't think we'd be adverse to having a conversation about, you know, how maybe eligibility ought to be expanded. There were choices that we did make, and we have tried to focus this primarily on agricultural production byproducts and ag lands because we believe that's where the primary future of biofuels will lie. So there have been some choices made, but for instance, the energy conversion subsidies, for instance, on line 7.4, that's very much opened up to a variety of ag-derived feedstocks. And perhaps if the algae is not viewed as agriculture, it would not qualify. But I think that's something we'd be happy to work with you or other innovators on to make it program eligible.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, and I guess my question would be, would CREP lands and other lands be available for this kind of plantings?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, you know, I think, you know, that's a question we'd have to raise with our federal delegation. Just, you know, CREP is you know, certainly participated in at the state level, but it's not up to the state, I'm sure, to make that decision without the federal cooperation, you know, of the Congress, you know. So I don't know. I would... You know, it seems to me that it's often difficult to get the Congress to move, so I don't know how eligible CREP lands would be, and I guess I'm sure there'd be some resistance, but we do want to keep those CREP lands for the purposes that they were originally set aside, too. We don't want to lose that benefit. I think there's some possibility there that we could use them for dual purposes, but whether the feds would be amenable to allowing that to happen or not, I don't know.
Mr. Arnasty.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, if I may be permitted, my opinion right now, in term, rather than representing the coalition, I think as we embark on a new generation of crops and a new method of getting energy in our country, what you're raising is, I would say, a good question that we should set aside for now while trust is built and systems are worked out. What we're proposing in this bill is incentive payments that would cover approximately 10,000 acres of Minnesota land. And, for instance, CRP land that is coming off contract, of which there are millions of acres over the next several years in Minnesota, would be ideal ideal opportunities. When we talk about changing the terms of existing covenants for existing land, such as CREP or CRP or RIM, for example, all of which have been discussed, we make certain set of folks nervous for whom those programs are important, the wildlife and outdoor folks. It's the same thing if we talk about saying we're trying to go after prime agricultural land where a production focus is important and highly efficient. What we're really trying to do is build trust and build the understanding that we can actually do production agriculture while retaining public values of wildlife and water quality. And we think maybe a few years into this program, if we're successful at that and we're able to prove that, then it might be appropriate to kind of open up past decisions and say, is this actually good management that should expand a little bit onto corn ground and a little bit onto CREP land? That's my personal opinion.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, and Mr. Arnasty, can you explain a little bit about the equipment loans, the capital equipment loans? Revolving loan?
Mr. Arnasty.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen. Thank you for the question. The thought about this is, as we move forward, there's going to be new activities, new economic activities that are going to need to take place that have not been taking place before. And it's a bit of a chicken and an egg. So I'll give an example that we've been using to conceptualize the need for these. For example, if we're going to be establishing mixed native perennial culture on agricultural lands, there's going to need to be some seed sources that haven't been there before. And some of those seed sources are going to be harvested off of existing native stands. They may be found on public lands. They may be found on private lands. The actual harvest machinery necessary for that, I've been told a 1970s era gleaner harvester is actually well adapted for this. So we're talking about really antique farm equipment that, as it happens, is well adapted for the future. There aren't a lot of those pieces of equipment around right now. A contract harvester might like to get into business, but they have a barrier of, you know, raising the funds necessary to buy and refurbish one of these and provide the seed necessary for doing that. We're thinking that might be an ideal candidate for a revolving loan, a low-interest loan, so that they can get into the business of providing the seeds that are going to be necessary as a result of this policy. There are other types of gathering and processing that would be needed for this kind of biofuels. A typical farmer these days, many of them no longer have hay baling equipment or storage facilities or the chopping capacity that would be necessary to put it in. Again, there may be some kind of a middleman type of business that would contract with a variety of farmers to be able to work with an energy facility and provide them with ready fuel or ready biomass. And that's the thinking that's been going on with this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Kubley, I'm going to shake up your bill a little bit. Good. You're supposed to laugh, Senator Kubley. Actually, I want to tell you about a project that's going down in my district. And the reason I bring up these loans is because on page 1, line 12, it says specific to persons participating in the Reinvest in Minnesota Clean Energy Program. Down in my district, two counties are talking about going together to do this very same program, cellulosic ethanol plant owned by the county.
Owned by the county?
Owned by the counties, right. They've already talked to Congressman Peterson about this, and there is some federal dollars out there that they are looking at trying to incorporate into this ethanol plant. And there is a cellulosic ethanol plant just over the border in Emmitsburg, about 30 minutes away. Roaring Companies is building that. Nobody has approached Minnesota at this point. For various reasons, I believe, in that area, as we probably all know about those reasons. But I'm just, putting this out there because this is starting to be visualized. And I, as a concept level in the county, it's kind of out there, but it's gaining momentum. They've already gone to the commissioners to talk about it. So I just want to leave that out there, saying perhaps we can open up these loans not to just say for persons, but also for counties that are investing in this.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Coopley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Rosen. It seems to me that, the state has traditionally not encouraged local units of government to go into competition with private enterprise. I suppose I sound like I'm a member of your caucus at the moment, but it does seem to me that somebody's looking for recruits, I think. But it does seem to me that the whole focus on local ownership to me is one of the strongest pieces of this kind of legislation. If you look at, and I'm not sure that wouldn't be borne out by a county, but I'm not sure that I would be supportive of, doing this for a local government entity. Hopefully, we're doing what we can for local units of government so that they wouldn't have to be in business. And I'm not sure, where that ought to go, I guess. But, I think it's certainly an interesting idea, and I know in times when funding is rather scarce, that it's always a temptation for local units of government to move in that direction. But I think, when Dr. Kildegard at the University of Minnesota at Morris did his study, primarily his study was done on wind energy, but, I think it applies to all forms of local ownership for business purposes. He looks at a 5.5 times the return that you get from an entity that might be located in another state. I assume that the economy is ethically neutral and wouldn't care whether that came from a local unit of government or not, but we might want to consider whether we want to encourage local units of government to be in competition with private enterprise.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
And thank you, Senator Coopley. I understand that. I'm just saying that the momentum has started, and it is being started by Congressman Peterson also. So there is some federal push on this end. Just to keep you abreast of it, I'm not planning on doing anything to your bill at this point. But it is fascinating to know that this is coming about also. My next comment I'd like to say, though, to Mr. Anastia is about and this is just more of a statement that I know the university is doing some work in this, but there's also a lot of other institutions that are working on this very various issue with ethanol, cellulosic ethanol, whatever you want to call it. I know MinSCU and specifically Minnesota State University is working on some. We have a development down in my area, too, where they're microwaving ethanol. Have you heard about that?
No, I have
not. It's truly amazing, and I wish I could give you the figures as far as how much energy it costs to develop ethanol with microwaves versus the traditional. I don't have it in front of me. And my other question, Madam Chair, was about easements. Can either Senator Coopley or Mr. Anastia talk to me about or tell me about easements? What do you exactly mean by easements? Just the short pieces of land that you're going to be contracting for here?
Sounds like she wants the 25 word, your last version.
Sure. Mr. Anastia.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, this refers to Section 4 of the bill, the RIM RE easements. And if you look at Subdivision 7 on page 9, we're talking about taking a 20-year or longer contract with a farmer who, in return for payments, would commit to growing a crop of a nature to be determined by the technical committee. And as I described, we're considering tiered approaches. In other words, several different levels of payment for several different approaches to what they would be doing, much like the conservation security program at the federal level. So the easement would be a limited duration contract between the state and the farmer, where the farmer would do certain farm practices and activities growing a bioenergy crop with other public values associated, like restrictions on harvest season to protect nesting wildlife, for example, or placement in the landscape to assure water quality improvement, so that we can achieve multiple public purposes on one piece of working farm ground. It's much like a federal CRP program right now.
Okay.
which is a 10 to 15 year program under the federal law. We were proposing 20 years so that we can get bonding money for it.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? Senator Jungbar.
Madam Chair and Senator Kubley, I have an amendment. I didn't have it officially made because I was looking into, as I'm looking at your legislation, I guess I was trying to think of all the other places it might fit, but to open up just a little bit and keep it under the ag thing. So let me run it by you members and see what you think. If you look at page 1, line 14, after production, you'd insert or, well, you wrote biomass, but bioenergy producers using agricultural feedstocks, both plant, animal, and byproducts. So we keep it agriculture-related. It would also open it up to biodiesel. Then page 5, line 26.
Just a minute, Senator Jungbar.
Okay,
could you give us that again, please?
Okay. Page 1, line 14, after production, insert or bioenergy producers using agricultural feedstocks, both plant, animal, and their byproducts. I'll explain that just a little bit quick while you guys are kind of writing it down. In my district, one of my constituents has invented a new biodiesel process. It's patented now. They're looking to set up their first, they want to start out with a 3 million gallon a day biodiesel. They're using soybean oil today, but you have the highest rate of return on beef tallow, so that, again, would be agriculture-related or byproduct. So it would open it up for potential loans or otherwise to get this stuff set up for that biodiesel type of thing. And for those that don't like the smell of diesel, they actually have some nice designer diesel flavors to go with that, where they are making it in a nice mint flavor. So, but I'd like to see a couple of these areas opened up to, if we're serious about, our bioenergy, alternative energies, we need to open this bill up. So the second area would be on page 5.
Is this a continuation of the same?
Same.
Okay.
Amendment. Page 5, line 26, after material, insert or other material composed of agricultural feedstocks, both plant, animal, and their byproducts. Do you want me to repeat that, Madam Chair?
You can repeat it again.
Okay, after material, insert or other material composed of agricultural feedstocks, both plant, animal, and their byproducts. So again, it keeps the intent of the agricultural, keeping it all within the agricultural industry, but I think it opens it up for all of our farmers and any other sorts of feedstocks to be able to potentially tap into some of these same sources of funds.
Senator Kubley, would you like to comment on that?
Well, Madam Chair and members, it does seem to me that amendment, it would be consistent with agricultural production, and on first glance at anyway, I think I would support it.
Okay. Everybody get the amendment? Do you need it repeated? Is there any? So that is a motion.
That's my motion to amend Senate Bill 480.
Okay, are there any questions or comments about that amendment? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Jungbar, when you say animal, can you give me a description of what you mean by that and their byproduct?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, as I started to talk about in my district, the constituent that has invented a new process for biodiesel, the highest production return is actually out of beef tallow. So I consider that an animal or an animal byproduct. So we'd want to make sure that if they're using that as a feedstock, that would be included for potential loans or otherwise. And they've run the production figures based on the U.S. Department of Agriculture's actual statistics of what it costs to produce bioenergy. And after startup and running for a period of a couple of years, it actually can exist without any supports. So it could exist initially without supports, but I think when we're turning the ship again, we need to give some incentives to get her moving.
Okay. Further questions or comments? Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Kubley, thank you for bringing this forward. You're a champion of agriculture and...
No, Senator Senjum, is this on the amendment?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
Okay. Then on the amendment, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, Senator, you're still a champion of agriculture. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of people in this room that want to be champions with you. I'm trying to understand this. No, you got to help me, and you got to just kind of bring it down to where I can understand it. Now, Senator Sparks and I come from an area of the state, probably Senator Rosen as well, where, you know, the corn grows high and the soybeans are flush. And yeah, we got some wetland and some brushland, but not a whole lot. You know, you got to look around for it to find a place to hunt your pheasants now. And you know, I don't know where we're going to put all the switchgrass. And so my question is simply, are we going to pay people to kind of replace the corn and the soybean land with switchgrass? Then are we in turn going to pay the producers to make the new ethanol, so to speak, off the switchgrass? And I'm just trying to understand.
Okay.
Because I don't, you know, I look around southern Minnesota and you know, unless we get some new land, and we're not going to have any of that, we're going to have to replace what we have now with a new crop. And so then can switchgrass really compete with corn and soybeans and all those good things we see out there all summer growing in those fields?
Senator, well, Madam Kubler. Chair and Senator Senjum, I think, you know, from an agricultural science perspective, 20% of the ag land in Minnesota is environmentally sensitive, and so it makes sense to me to kind of, you know, designate 10,000 acres of that for, you know, this style of production. You know, I don't think it would necessarily take anything away from the acres that are already being used or are good for corn, soybean, or alfalfa production, whatever commodities you happen to grow in an area. But if you look at page 8, lines 4 and following, it does describe a designation process for project areas. You know, I think if you look at the map that designates where the ethanol plants are in the state of Minnesota right now, you'll discover that the vast majority of them are in the southern half of the state. And while I think, you know, portions of what is described in this bill would be adopted quite early by, you know, the ethanol plants that are already in production, they would probably only use the cellulosic materials, you know, for a portion of the year. And I understand there's also a point in the process where you can blend the current production style that's totally corn-based with the prairie grasses, you know. But I think if you look at the research that Drs. Tillman and Hill have done at the University of Minnesota, you know, there is more of that that land that's considered environmentally sensitive in the northern half of the state, and it would succeed in moving the production of this alternative fuel across the state and also utilize more acres that that are not really good for the crops that are currently being produced and are currently providing most of the cash for Minnesota's ag economy across the state and aid us in gaining a little wider sense of becoming energy independent. It does seem to me that, you know, if all of the ethanol plants that are corn-based were currently online, we would use about 35% of the nation's corn supply, and we would be producing about 5% of our fuel. If the cellulosic materials give us the kind of return that we that you know the early promise indicates, we could look at producing over half of our fuel supply, and we're looking at certainly then a method of becoming at least semi-independent from those areas of the world that are pretty politically volatile.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olsen?
This might be more of a comment. One of the other things I hear is the corn stover would be a good product, which southern Minnesota is going to has an awful lot of. But the other thing is, like, in one of my districts just redid their comprehensive plan, and we're a growing area, maybe moving more towards the suburb. And in preserving open lands, the prairie grasses may be in doing cluster homes where the homes are put closer together and open land is preserved. It'd be an ideal situation to have prairie grasses on the rest of the land, and if it's harvested once a year. So in my area and to the north, I agree that the northern part of the state has an awful lot of lands that could be put into the prairie grasses and producing a lot of this material. So I see it as a win for everybody. It's really a unique opportunity.
Well, yeah, Senator Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, I do think that, you know, the bill does allow for the use of things like corn stover. I know there are some groups that feel that you can't use the organic material off the same piece of land year after year after year, that you have to allow the return of some of that organic material to the soils to be, you know, to keep your soil productivity where it needs to be for the production of those crops. So yes, I think you can use it, and this bill does provide for that use. But, you know, it doesn't give you the same kind of return. It does give you a better return than you get from the grain alone. But, you know, we do provide for an incentive for that kind of material to be used as well.
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's more to Senator Sinjum to comment. We're not, I think, in general terms, nobody's trying to take cropland out of production. And if we used all the corn in the United States today, we would only be able to turn that into 10% of what energy we use today in terms of fuel. So we don't want it all to go there because it messes artificially with food prices and stuff. But where you can plant this material is filtering areas where we have field drain tiles. I actually have a bill up because it takes the sedimentation out of what runs into our lakes, streams, and rivers if you filter around the entrance of a drain tile system. When you're terracing croplands in order to protect it from erosion, this becomes the perfect buffer zone, the biograsses. Poor croplands, where Tillman did his research, happens to be a mile north of my house in the Cedar Creek Natural History Area where I've worked as a youth and stuff, it's really poor cropland. It's sandy soils. You can't produce a large bushel per acre, and you could actually do more on this kind of a cropland. And as Senator Olsen suggested, eco-friendly developments. As we look for more open space, you can plant this multitude of prairie grasses or other cellulosic base, harvest it once a year. So you're not looking to supplant the agriculture today. You're actually looking to enhance other areas in ways that do a number of things at the same time, carbon sequestration and provide a cellulosic base.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll keep this brief because I know you wanted to click along here, but something that is happening down in the ethanol production area, of course, water is an issue. And I know you, with cellulosic ethanol, it takes less water to develop. But they're also talking, and this is very upsetting, especially for an old retired agronomist as myself, to start corn on corn, and that would be very bad for the land. So cellulosic ethanol is a nice continuation of what we're doing as far as renewable fuels. But we do have some serious issues before we even get to this next generation here about permitting, and I don't want to put a damper on your bill, Senator Kubley, but there are some issues here that why we are not getting the development in this state. And so we have to keep that in perspective also.
Well, and Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, those of us that attend a rural caucus that is, you know, primarily our caucus, I guess we tried it to be bipartisan in the past, you know, but it didn't work out too well. We only had one person who came. But, you know, we did talk about that very issue this morning with the commissioner from PCA, and I think he was supportive in looking at ways that we can reduce that length of time, but I do think there, you know, if you check on page 11, section 8 talks about, you know, some dollars going to PCA to permit new and emerging facility or technologies, but, you know, it doesn't actually specify that we need to speed that process up. Hopefully, if we can develop a method of producing a biofuel that uses less water. I mean, I think water is going to be a huge issue in the future. It's already a big issue in some parts of the state. I know parts of the state that I represent, some of the counties I represent, it's a large issue already. And, you know, we've lost several plants, as you probably know, that have slid over the state line into Iowa just because of our permitting process, and that's an area of the state where there seems to be adequate supplies of water. So, you know, I don't know. I guess for you and Senator Sparks, and I don't know, Senator Senjum, you know, I guess, you know, maybe Rochester will want to be planting some cellulosic material in their tree spaces in downtown Rochester. I'm sure
I have it in my lawn.
I think we want to move the bill along at this point, right. Okay? Is there somebody that would like to move the bill as amended?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 480 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussion? You know, I didn't ask if there was anybody out there that wanted to testify for or against the bill. Seeing none, then, anybody will vote on the bill? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you. Senator Kubley, 904, then.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senate File 904, you know, is a bill that would create a loan fund, and it's primarily aimed at local units of government that might not invest in a geothermal system for their energy because of the cost, and it's just an attempt to, you know, I do think, you know, there are examples around the state, and maybe we could accomplish some of that by a little education. I know the city of Appleton converted their civic center to geothermal, and they felt that they got a payback in terms of what they saved on their energy bills within a span of 8 months. That's the shortest time frame I've ever heard. But, you know, I called and checked on that with them, and they still say it was 8 months. So I think the average length of time is about 6 years. Something a little less than 6 years is right in the ballpark. I know we had some good friends who put it in a new home that they built on a lake. And for the average energy bills using conventional heating and cooling methods, In a home of their square footage, they felt that they got a payback in about 5 years and 10 months. So that's right in the ballpark there. But this is intended, and I don't know, you know, with the targets that are coming out, Madam Chair, I'm not sure that we're going to have money to put into something like this. But it does seem to me that, you know, the state could go a long way toward helping local units of government save a lot of money over the long haul. They could actually pay back this revolving loan fund with the savings that they have from their energy bills. And
Senator Kubley, if they're already recouping their money in 8 months, why do they need a loan?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess I, you know, like I say, I think that's the only one out there that I found that is that short. But you know, I don't know. You know, I guess it was just an idea that I had to help, you know, local units of government to implement something that looks to me like they could save money for 20 years and lower the cost of delivering government services for that period of time as well.
Okay. Craig Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. We did not work in advance with Representative Kubley on this bill, but we very much appreciate him bringing it forward. The League did take a position on a number of sustainable development and renewable energy issues this year for the first time, and this bill is exactly matches the league's position that we really do encourage the state to come up with incentive programs that would help local units of government. In a number of cases, and geothermal being one of them, the initial startup costs can be high enough that many, especially smaller local units of government, would be intimidated by that and might instead go with more conventional energy, maybe just put in a higher efficiency furnace, when in fact, over the long haul, as Senator Kubley pointed out, it might be much better for them to go this route, both cost-wise and for a more sustainable energy need. So we support the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions or comments? Anybody else in the audience that wish to speak on the bill? Okay, then Senator Olsen, or I guess Senator.
I'd love to.
Okay, Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 904 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance. Any questions or comments? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. 1011, Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have an amendment for this bill that you should have in your packets, I believe, and if someone would be willing to move that for me.
Madam Chair, I'll move the author's amendment on 1011.
The A1 amendment?
The A1 amendment.
Okay, Senator Olsen moves the A1 amendment to put it in the author's desired format. Any questions or comments? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Kubley.
Madam Chair and members, this bill actually came to me from one of my House members who was pursuing it from the standpoint of some folks that had requested that it be done that live in our district. It just gives a credit, a one-time credit for the installation of a geothermal heating and cooling system. And lists the specific kinds of things that it would be available for. You'll notice on line 20 on page 1 that it does list the things that would be exempt. It's a fairly simple bill, but. And I don't know how that would impact the state. I guess I was thinking that it was going to be from the utilities, and maybe that's implied there. Maybe Mr. Fuller could speak to that issue.
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair. Senator Kubley, members, that's how I read it. It's the utility is obligated to make the payment. I don't see state involvement.
So do we have anybody from the utilities to speak on this? Senator Dibble.
I'm sorry. Do we give enough time for folks to come forward? I see I'm a co-author, Madam Chair, on this bill. but would think that it probably has some implications for the bill I'm bringing forward on Thursday. I don't mind its passage necessarily, but I do think we need to probably consider how this fits into the spending requirements and the energy savings requirements that the larger, more global conservation and efficiencies bill that we're bringing forward has. I mean, can't integrate this on the fly in my brain and synthesize it, but.
Sure.
So would it be appropriate to
context,
Madam Chair? I think the amendment spoke to some of the. Mm-hmm. Well, the amendment was actually suggested by the utility companies, Madam Chair. So, I think that may have addressed some of those concerns that Senator Dibble's addressing. But,
Madam Chair,
Senator Dibble,
As I understand, the amendment just confines it then to electrical utilities. My bill would also be of concern to electrical utilities. It just does not, it's not confined to natural gas utilities. So it, I'd say it still is, doesn't satisfy. I mean, we still need to kind of consider this in light of that bill.
So you're saying there's a fiscal impact to the utilities and that it's something that should be considered in light of the conservation bill that you're bringing forward?
Yeah, we just need to have, I mean, we just need to have conversation to make sure it fits in with. And I mean, I think it does, Madam Chair. I think it's just that, you know, and it's a good thing. It's just we need to, you know, consider it in light of that bill's requirements as well. It probably rolls nicely into, and I would be interested in the utility's response. It rolls nicely into what would be their mandates that bill would ask for.
So perhaps you could tell me what kind of an impact that would be of a minimum one-time credit of $200 per ton. I don't know how many tons there might be in a geothermal heating and cooling equipment system.
Well, Madam Chair, you know, I do have some information from the utilities, and you know, they list basically the pounds per year. It does get into the tonnage, but you know, on a private residence, I don't think the numbers are not huge. You know, I can certainly, you know, share these with the committee, but I think it's probably more information than you want to digest at this point. But
so, Senator Dibble, are you suggesting that Senator Dibble? Senator Dibble, are you suggesting that this may be a form of the conservation or the the money that is spent on energy efficiency by the utility companies, that it may be counted as a credit?
Madam Chair, it may. I mean, I think that seems to be the goal of this bill, is that, you know, folks would be saving energy, which is a good thing, and we're asking the utilities to figure out how, you know, on the demand side, customers can save energy. You know, this is measured, of course, by the amount of money that gets spent. You know, the central premise of the bill being brought forward is the amount of energy that's saved.
So what if we were to roll, just lay this over for possible inclusion in your conservation bill?
That would be fine. And I think Mr. Fuller also had some questions. I don't know if he has the answers. And I would be interested in Senator Kubley's reaction to that. I don't want to kill his bill, of course, but
okay. Mr. Fuller is telling me that it has tax implications too, that you're asking for a tax credit. Is that correct?
Sales
tax exemption on it also. So the bill needs, or at least that portion of it needs to go on to taxes. And you're suggesting delete this?
Delete section one and hold it over, just, you know, the concept.
Okay.
And then send the rest.
So one option would be to delete section one and for us to inform Senator Dibble that it may be something that could be included in the conservation bill and refer the rest of it on to taxes for the sales tax exemption. That would be one way. Senator Carlson, you had a question.
I just wanted to clarify some numbers there. That typically, a ton is 36,000 BTUs per hour, and typically you only use tons to describe cooling capacity. You use BTUs per hour for heating. So when you talk about tons, you're really talking about cooling capacity. And a typical home is probably 2.5 tons. And a large home might be as much as 5 or 6 tons.
So that could be a substantial credit then?
Could be a substantial credit.
Not compared to the cost of
not
geothermal.
Compared to the cost, right.
Does it say? Could be a school?
Could be, sure. Except that then you're talking
could
about
have taxes, significant cost implications for the utility. Mm-hmm. And with all we're laying on them right now, I think we need to at least be cautious. I'm suggesting that we, and somebody can make this motion, that we delete Section 1.
That would be fine, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Subdivision 1 of Section 1?
Section 1, yeah. And then send Section 2 on to taxes. So we divide the bill, or just delete the bill first. I mean, delete Section 1 first.
So, Madam Chair, just to be clear, so delete lines 1.6 through 1.15?
7.
1.17.
1.7 to 1.15?
No, to 1.17 through
1.17.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Would you like to make that motion?
And, oh, okay. I'm now.
And will you accept that as a suggestion to include it in your, or to discuss it at least in the conservation bill?
Right. And yeah, with the Haitian. So Senator Kubley to come see how this might fit into the conservation bill.
Totally getting rid of this.
Okay.
All right, I'll make that motion.
Okay, so Senator Dibble moves that Section 1 be deleted from the bill. Any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Olsen.
I don't understand what's left then.
There is a tax credit for geothermal equipment.
At 1.14?
No, Madam Chair, I had the same question until I figured out what Section 2 actually meant. So maybe Mr. Fuller can explain what Section 297A.67 is. That's a tax exemption of some sort.
Madam Chairman, members, I probably should look it up because I'm going by memory. But I think it's the sales tax exemption. So when you purchase this equipment, so actually the terminology in Section 1 is incorrect, which is what might be confusing people mm-hmm. on line 14. We're not talking about a credit. We're talking about an exemption. Because you'll notice on line 21, it says they are exempt. Good idea. So we're talking about sales tax exemption. So Darlene's looking up right now, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is. We should probably wait just 1 second. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, that's correct. They're sales tax exemptions.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, does Senator Olsen understand what's left?
Yeah, thank
okay.
you.
Okay, so on Senator Dibble's motion to amend the bill by deleting Section 1 then, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Then on the remainder of the bill, is there a motion to send this to taxes?
Madam Chair, I'll move Senate File 1011 as amended to be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. And Senator Kubley, you have one last bill.
Yeah, well, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 538, there were a number of suggestions made. Mr. Fuller has actually drafted a couple of amendments here, but I believe, Mr. Fuller, that your comment was that the A4 amendment met the criteria of most of the members. Is that correct?
The A4, yes.
The A4 amendment, correct.
Okay. Let's pull up the A4 amendment. Now, remember that Senator Kubley did give us a presentation on this bill before. And so before us is the A4 amendment. And what does the A4 amendment do?
Well, the A4 amendment, I don't see that it really changes the primary thrust of the bill, Madam Chair and members, but it does... It simply just asks that state buildings that come to us seeking dollars to redo traditional or conventional types of heating and cooling systems that they they look at the applications of geothermal and see what the long-term implications of that might be. It could be, another form. In my opinion, it doesn't necessarily preclude other forms of renewable energy, but, I think geothermal does offer some very significant savings in the long term, and so it simply asks that they look at a geothermal style of heating and cooling that could, once again, save us pretty significant dollars over the long haul.
Okay. Mr. Fuller, would you explain the amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, members, Senator Senjum and others had asked questions because in the original bill it said when practicable, it should be given preference to geothermal. And so that, I think, is what's taken out instead of a preference or just, take a look at it and see if it works for you sort of approach is what the amendment does. But make sure you take a look at it.
But Senator Kubley, I'm still not sure that this addresses my concern. My concern is, does this indicate that a design needs to be drafted for a geothermal system in order to be considered for funding by the state? And if so, I feel that would be an awful expense to be placed on a design coming before the state.
Well, Madam
Chair. Especially if they don't go forward with that design. But I'm hearing from Mr. Fuller that it doesn't require that.
Yeah, I think the statute section that is listed in the bill, 16B.335, speaks to that question. I don't know. Mr. Fuller, do you have a comment on that?
Mr. Fuller.
Members, the way I interpreted this and the intent was to say that those projects that are subject to pre-design review, prior to doing your pre-design, you'll consider if that pre-design will have geothermal heating and cooling application in it. That was the intent, and I think that's what it says. That doesn't require you to pre-design on that basis. It requires you to consider that as you think about your pre-design, and if you don't have to include it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olstein.
I really like the idea of, when we're hearing there's heat cost recouping, was it 8 years for the one town? There's an opportunity for us as a state here to, the investment might be higher in the front end, but the recoup on the heating and the cooling is, and the energy savings is so dramatic that I guess I wouldn't want to harm the language to encourage us to do this for state facilities. And as I read this, it just seems like it simplified the language. It's a very clear statement in a lot less words than the original bill. So, but if Mr. Fuller could kind of reiterate for me that it hasn't weakened it, it just kind of made it more to the point.
Well, I'd like to speak to that. I mean, what happens if there's a heat recovery systems or solar systems or other systems that are maybe even more energy efficient and more cost effective? I'm not understanding why this thrust for geothermal at this time and why it shouldn't just be an energy efficient heating and cooling system that should be considered.
Those are all good points.
yeah, Madam Chair, I tried to say that, it does seem to me that the amendment does specifically designate geothermal, but I don't think we want to exclude, other forms of renewable applications. So could we add that? Could we amend the amendment to say geothermal or other renewable applications, so that we don't exclude things that might be developed in the future?
Mr. Fuller, do you have language that could do that?
Madam Chair, members, I'm not totally familiar with what's required for, a state building project, but I'm pretty certain that energy efficiency is one of the items that project proposers have to consider. So I think that's already subject to review. And so all those things would probably already be on the table. You know what I mean? But that's Senator Jungbaum. I can't call on you.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my thought.
Okay. Senator Jungbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, sometimes we get a little informal, and I like that. We should keep this discussion somewhat informal as we put that thought process out. But more and more, and I can use wastewater as a primary example, we're going through rule changes that way. But any city, county, any wastewater treatment facility, we're now mandating that they go through this checklist somewhat the same in terms of being more environmentally friendly, because often we go the cheapest route, whether we're presenting something government or otherwise, instead of going through the long-term implications. So to Mr. Fuller's comment, energy efficiency doesn't include the thought process of renewable, the thought process of long-term operating expenses. And I see that Senator Kubley, that's his main thrust here, is many times in putting something together, whether it be a school, which we see a lot of the new schools going up, we're not looking at the long-term operating costs in the geothermal or any other equivalent or any other alternative renewable source would deal with the long-term operating costs and looking at a review of that. And it's not I'm trying to think of the language we just went through. I was at a three-day wastewater treatment seminar. We talked about how they implemented the review process such that they didn't have to go through a full engineering or design, but created a worksheet, you know, probably somewhat similar to an environmental impact statement versus an environmental assessment. So there's a way to get around that. I'm not sure how to do it now, but I think we're all in agreement that that's the right way to go.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Jungbauer. But I think Ms. Myers here from admin, she and former Representative Rhodes visited me on this issue, and I think maybe she can shed some light on that for the committee.
Ms. Myers.
Madam Chair, Heidi Myers. I'm the state architect with the Department of Administration. Our office does the pre-design program, and we also do the review process for the pre-design. So we update the manuals and review them. In the there is a statute that requires all new buildings to meet sustainable design guidelines that would incorporate looking at alternate energy sources, life cycle costs as part of that activity that happens. The pre-design process is an appropriate time to look at these alternate energy sources to make sure that we include them as we go forward before a design gets implemented. So in that aspect, admin is in favor of doing this particular work during the pre-design process. I do believe that there's another statute that requires us to look at alternate energy sources besides the sustainable design guidelines.
So if you're already looking at that, does this bill actually make a difference?
I am not sure how it would make a difference. It would just probably emphasize the fact that we need to consider geothermal as one of the alternates.
Okay. Senator Jungbaum.
Well, Madam Chair, I think the whole point is if it's not specifically stated some of the options we're looking at, it's very easy to not put them in your checkoff sheet. So I would agree with Senator Kubley that specifically stating geothermal other renewables into statute, if the statute already exists, is pretty simple, and we can just make sure that somewhere on their pre-design checkoff sheet we know that they've looked at it and put it into the factors somewhere.
Okay. Mr. Fuller has an amendment to the amendment.
Madam Chair, this basically quotes what Senator Jungbauer just said. On page 1, line 5, after geothermal, add and other renewable energy. So it would read, geothermal and other renewable energy applications must be considered. And then just what he said.
Okay, so we haven't moved on your amendment. Would you be willing to accept that as an oral amendment?
Fine, Madam Chair.
Okay, all right. To incorporate that in your amendment, then. Is there somebody that would move Senator Kubley's amendment as with the oral amendment? Senator Sanjum? Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Then on the bill, is there a motion on the bill?
Just a comment when you get ready.
Okay. Senator Rummel. Moves Senate File 538 as amended. And discussion, Senator Senjum. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Kubley, just to maybe get your intent a little bit more. So now as we would have new buildings around Minnesota, the issue of geothermal or other renewables or alternatives would need to be considered. And I don't know what that process might be. I think, for instance, at Bemidji State University a couple of years ago, we were on a bonding trip, and they need a new boiler. And literally the powerhouse is from here to the wall away from Lake Bemidji. And I'm thinking about the theater in Rochester and the geothermal and all. I mean, it's a perfect place. You could run all the coils out there in the lake, and you could bring that heat in and pump it out. And I mean, it just seemed like a perfect application. And I don't think they've got their boiler fixed yet, so maybe it's still in play. But in a situation like that, if the chief engineer or the president of the college or whoever just said, well, I mean, we thought about it, but we kind of like the old boiler. Has that person met the test in terms of consideration?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, I guess, you know, I would have to leave those kinds of considerations up to admin. You know, it does seem to me that the Department of Administration has some guidelines that they follow, and I suspect that they would make their recommendations to the college or, you know, other quasi-governmental unit that was considering that kind of replacement. It does seem to me that if you're showing them the numbers and the numbers indicate that there's significant savings there, that they would be interested in taking, you know, a route that is both environmentally friendly and offers the kinds of savings that we've talked about in the examples.
Madam Chair, I'm just thinking there are people that are not risk takers, and you know how they manage the statute is probably going to occur in a whole variety of ways, somewhat informal most of the time, I suspect.
Okay, Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, I have the same concern that Senator Senjum does, and that is that oftentimes you, in a situation like this, you have the capital cost so far away from the operational cost, and the operational cost will be much less with the geothermal system, but the capital cost is going to be huge in comparison. So consideration might mean, no, we can't afford it in the capital project, would pay for it forever in operational costs because they come out of a different pocket. And that would be the end of the consideration.
Well, maybe it's an educational problem then, huh? Senator Olsen.
Well, I think that's where Senate File 904 kind of comes into play, where we have a revolving loan for those buildings that, you know, hopefully they will kind of look outside the box and say, if we go with this and we get the revolving loan from the state and pay it back over time. And I mean, it's like Senator Jungbauer says, we're trying to turn the ship here, and I guess it is incrementally. So,
okay. So Senator Rummel renews her motion that Senate File 538 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
You, Madam Chair. And sorry, but I voted on a couple of my bills, even though I'm not a member.
Senator Anderson.
All right. Madam Chair and members, thank you for being flexible, and thanks to Rolf Nordstrom for waiting as I was gone for a little bit. Senate File 1282 is the Renewable Hydrogen Initiative bill, and members who have served on the Energy Committee in previous years will recognize a lot of what is in this bill. This is similar and in some cases identical to legislation that I brought forward last year. Much of it is, and passed the Senate in the Omnibus Energy Bill, one of the many good pieces of legislation that that died a sad death at the very end of the session when we weren't able to bring them up on the House floor for a variety of reasons. So this is, and it's a continuation of a discussion we've had since the Minnesota legislature adopted what's, I brought the statute book to the table with me so I could read this to you. In 216B.8109, we did adopt in 2003 a goal in this state that Minnesota moves to hydrogen as an increasing source of energy for its electrical power, heating, and transportation needs. And so we've had several bills over the last few years to try to move us forward in that direction in a gradual, incremental way, probably not nearly as fast as we'd like to see, but at least making some steps in that direction. And a number of states around the country have taken really significant steps towards promoting hydrogen research and development and demonstration projects in their states. And so this is a step in that direction for the state of Minnesota. Essentially, the bill has four main parts. First, to get the to formalize the Minnesota Renewable Hydrogen Initiative within the Department of Commerce. This is one of the pieces that we worked on last year with Deputy Commissioner Garvey and was all agreed to with the department about how they would take this on in a formal way to try to promote hydrogen development in our state. The second piece is an appropriation to move that to the next level, as well as developing hydrogen, the roadmap and the plan for our state, but also to do some to help to fund some cutting edge programs that will move us in that direction in Minnesota. There's two more sections relating to procurement and adoption of uniform codes and standards for the use and production of hydrogen. And I'm just going to leave my comments at that. Rolf Nordstrom is here with me, and he is really Mr. Hydrogen. He is the person who knows more about this than anyone in Minnesota and has devoted many, many years to trying to further the research and development and leadership role of Minnesota in the area of hydrogen.
So, Senator Anderson, before we move on, would you like to offer the A1 amendment to get it into the author's desired format?
Sure.
And I think, well, I understand that since last year they've just renumbered the sections, so this takes care of that.
The A1 is a technical amendment that I would like to offer, if the members have that already.
Okay. On the A1 amendment, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we could have Mr. Nordstrom explain this in detail.
Mr. Nordstrom.
Hello. Excuse me. I'm just finishing cold. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rolf Nordstrom. I'm the director of something called the Upper Midwest Hydrogen Initiative, which is a public-private coalition run under the auspices of the nonprofit Great Plains Institute. We're based in Minneapolis. We're based here, but we serve a region that includes the province of Manitoba, North and South Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. So we're small but aspiring to serve a large region. Excuse me. And as Senator Anderson mentioned, virtually all of the components of this bill passed the Senate last year, except for the appropriation, which was not included last year. I'm, of course, hoping, we're hoping, that it will prove equally appealing and compelling this year. And before I just have a few remarks, I know the hour is late, so I won't take a lot of your time. I'd like to start, though, by thanking Senator Anderson. I know she hasn't done this alone, but for her vision and seeing that a comprehensive energy strategy really needs to have a mid- and long-term component as well. And this bill would add that mid- and long-term component by moving the state toward use of renewable hydrogen alongside biofuels and renewable electricity as sort of part of our homegrown energy portfolio, if you will. And just to give you a sense, I mean, if this all still feels like something out of the Jetsons to you, you know, fuel cells and hydrogen, I just wanted to give you a taste for what is happening elsewhere. There are at least 15 countries around the world that are investing heavily in hydrogen and fuel cells as a part of their energy future. There are, believe it or not, 47 of the 50 states, including the District of Columbia, have some form of hydrogen and fuel cell activity in their states, either some more modest than others, including tax incentives and support for early deployments, that sort of thing. Indeed, to our west, North Dakota, the North Dakota House has just passed a bill that's similar, though not identical, to the bill that's before you today, and I expect that will have pretty clear sailing in the Senate, since the governor and leadership there have already taken credit for it. So I think it's boding well in North Dakota. And actually, in the North Dakota bill, they've passed a more modest appropriation to allow Fargo to participate, coordinate with Morehead in developing a joint hydrogen transit bus and refueling station project, which both of those cities are committed to doing, would very much like to do. And then this year, I know people have maybe seen some of this in the press, but General Motors has announced that this year they're going to put on the streets as many as 100 fuel cell vehicles in California, New York, and Washington, D.C., where there already exists hydrogen refueling stations, as sort of the world's largest road test in preparation for mass introduction of fuel cell vehicles by 2011, which, by my estimation, is not very far away. And both Honda and BMW have announced plans to go to limited production with hydrogen vehicles, different types of hydrogen vehicles, but hydrogen vehicles by the end of the decade. So there's a lot of activity, and that's actually just the tip of the iceberg. And while the popular press has devoted most of their attention to hydrogen and fuel cell use in passenger vehicles, there are actually a whole slew of applications that are at sort of a commercialization tipping point for which some modest public investment could actually make the difference, things like forklifts, believe it or not. Fuel cell-powered forklifts are very close to commercial today if you have a large materials handling facility like a Target or something like that, or 3M for that matter. Airport vehicles, shuttle buses, ice refinishers even. You'd know it as Zambonis, but not necessarily made by that company. Fuel cells for emergency and backup power, the kind of thing that might have helped during Katrina. Fuel cells are being pushed in that niche market. And even groundskeeping equipment. And, in fact, it may come as some surprise, but Minnesota-based Toro Company is just now finishing building its first four hydrogen fuel cell groundskeeping vehicles, a truck, kind of like an ant, which can carry many times its own weight, and then a greens mower. And they are going to be deploying those, not here, but in the state of New York, as part of a large program where they're going to be making hydrogen at Niagara Falls in New York. New York has a $21 million hydrogen and fuel cell program underway, and Toro is participating in that. Of course, we wish they were deploying their vehicles here in their home turf. For example, why not mow the University of Minnesota's golf course with hydrogen fuel cell greens mowers? The students would love to drive those, I know. Or why not at the university's new stadium keep the grounds maintained with hydrogen vehicles there, or the Duluth Lakefront, or any number of other places across the state? Minnesota has a good cluster of manufacturing companies, none of which make fuel cells, the whole fuel cell, but many of which make components that go in them, companies like 3M and Integris and Donaldson and so forth. But Minnesota's comparative advantage is probably not necessarily going to be in the fuel cell, but in the production of hydrogen, which we could make from any of our renewable energy resources, wind, biomass, solar, ethanol, methane from anaerobic digesters, or wastewater treatment plants, all kinds of possibilities there. Bless you. And several technologies have been developed at the University of Minnesota. At least two that I'm aware of, potentially low-cost hydrogen production technologies developed at the university, but not yet scaled up to see if they are viable as in commercial use. So that's something we'd very much like to see happen. And, in fact, I would argue that if you added up the economic potential of renewable hydrogen production in the state, along with biofuels and renewable electricity, it really could actually – I don't think it's overstating it to say that it could mean a rural renaissance in Minnesota, because all of these things – require what landowners have, whether it's wind or biomass or access to the sunshine. Xcel Energy already has a wind to hydrogen project that they've got underway in Colorado, where they will be making hydrogen using wind power, getting the hydrogen from water, and storing that hydrogen, effectively finding they are using this as a way to store wind power, if you think of it that way, because they've used the wind power to get, through electrolysis, to get hydrogen from water. And then that hydrogen can be used either in vehicles or to produce electricity when the wind is not blowing. And Xcel Energy is working on a similar project out at the Morris University campus. But wind, of course, is not the only option. There was a 2005 study done by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory that concluded that if you took all of the residual biomass, ag waste and wood waste, and converted it using the most efficient process, the hydrogen that you could generate could displace a significant portion of Minnesota's gasoline use and our electricity use. So what does the bill do? I won't belabor this because Senator Anderson already did a really nice job summarizing this. This Minnesota Renewable Hydrogen Initiative, though, has been informally operating within the Department of Commerce for several years. So the first part of this bill simply formalizes that and takes the statutory goal that Senator Anderson read and gives formal responsibility to the Department of Commerce for achieving that goal by developing a roadmap and coming up with kind of a logical stepwise fashion for achieving this statutory goal that we already have. And then the codes and standards part, it's just a barrier. It's not unique to Minnesota, but obviously if you're going to do anything with hydrogen or you want to install a fuel cell here in the Capitol, everybody from the fire marshal to the building code officials will have questions about, is that safe? Can we do it? You know, what are the setbacks? And having a uniform set of codes and standards would simply help the industry move much more quickly so that every single city and town in Minnesota doesn't have to climb that same codes and standards mountain again and have the same conversation with the fire marshal about whether or not this is safe and okay to do. I'm close to done here. So given that Minnesota could, I think it's fair to say, really be a national leader in producing hydrogen from renewable resources, our members believe it's really important for Minnesota to invest early in the same ways that we have for ethanol and biodiesel and wind, and help get make real progress on the statutory goal that we already have. One last thing that I'd like to say is that hydrogen doesn't just offer Minnesota yet another clean fuel option. It is that, but it's more than that, because hydrogen can be made from so many things and from all of the other primary energy resources that we have. And it's also not just about the fuel. It's about everything else you would need to use hydrogen, so the distribution of it, the storage of it, and the end use of it. I think the Toro example and what Xcel Energy is doing are just two small examples of what might be done if we move in this direction. So on behalf of our members, I urge you to pass Senate File 1282, and I thank you very much for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Nordstrom, are you able to give us an indication of how much of our energy needs hydrogen could fulfill?
Yes, all of them. I mean, Madam Chair, members, that was a little flip, and I apologize. I should say hydrogen could really, in fact, there was a study done under the National Academies of Science and Engineering that suggests that hydrogen in the transportation market could replace all of gasoline. But I think it's really important for me to emphasize that hydrogen is not a source of energy. In fact, if I could make one amendment to the statute, the goal as it exists in statute, I would change the word source. Because it takes some primary form of energy to get hydrogen from something that contains it. So it has more in common with electricity than it does with, say, coal or oil or even solar power. Just like electricity is not just lying around, right? We have to produce it using something else, and we mostly use coal. Hydrogen is the same way. You have to get it from something else that contains it, like water, and you have to use some energy to do that. So that's the sort of broader explanation, but the National Renewable Energy Laboratory did an analysis of, if you took all of the renewable energy across the country, solar, wind, biomass, et cetera, they wanted to answer the question, could you produce enough hydrogen to meet all of the country's needs? And the answer is not just yes, but by, I forget what the factor is. I mean, you could produce, much more than we would need, let's put it that way. Just taking the Class 3 wind resources and above in North and South Dakota could produce 50 million tons of hydrogen a year, and we'd need about 40 million tons to serve an entire U.S. car fleet. So, I mean, having enough of it is not the issue. It's, at the moment, it's simply a matter of other things being cheaper, and we haven't looked to hydrogen as a fuel.
So this hydrogen could be a bridge for storing wind energy?
Right.
And taking out that unreliability factor?
I think that's exactly. That's one possibility. That's one reason why Xcel Energy, in fact, I wish I had brought the – they have a very nice 3-minute and 7-minute DVD that explains what they're doing in Colorado with the National Renewable Energy Lab with this wind-to-hydrogen project. But that's exactly what they're trying to test. Can they use wind power to produce hydrogen and then store the hydrogen – and use that. In this project, they're going to use it in a generator, like a turbine, gas turbine, and produce electricity when the wind is not available. And they're doing several other things with that project. For example, since we haven't really done that before, the electronic interfaces between the turbine and the electrolyzer, none of those things have been optimized. So there are some inefficiencies, flip-flopping between AC and DC and so forth. And in all candor, it may turn out that producing electricity with the hydrogen may not be the best use because the round-trip efficiency, the round-trip losses may be, you know, greater than we want to stomach. But using it as a vehicle fuel, that right now we know from another project that is going on in Minot, North Dakota, wind to hydrogen project, is, you know, somewhere in the 55% efficiency range. So, but it could be a storage medium for not just wind but other renewables like solar, if that turns out to pan out. Yeah.
So currently there are some inefficiencies, though, and apparently it's costly.
Well, hydrogen would be, Madam Chair and members, hydrogen would be cost competitive with gasoline today if the hydrogen were going to be used in a fuel cell vehicle. If you were making hydrogen from natural gas on site at the filling station scale, kind of at that scale, on a mile per driven basis, hydrogen would be cost competitive with gasoline today. So making it from renewables is more expensive, but there certainly is a loss. We would violate the laws of physics if there wasn't some loss when you produce hydrogen. But in a way, with all due respect, I think the right question is not just how big is the efficiency loss each time you make a change, but how much useful work can you do with it and compared to what? I mean, for example, nobody complains too bitterly that the electric grid that lights these lights is about 33% efficient. You know, by the time you, so think about that. Every three carloads, you know, trainloads of coal, just one is doing the useful work, and the other two were just sort of vaporizing up into the atmosphere.
And I wasn't suggesting that it was inefficient.
No,
I'm just trying to find what's the relative factor with other sources of energy. That's all.
I appreciate that.
And I understand it's still in its infancy, too.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is still a really volatile gas, isn't it? I mean, do you handle it like propane or on a, if we go to this as a fuel source, how do we distribute it?
Handle it.
Mr. Nordstrom.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm sorry, I can't see your
Olsen,
I'm sorry. The glare was not quite right. It's a good question. As you might imagine, it's a question I get everywhere I do public speaking. The nightmare for me as somebody who's trying to promote hydrogen and fuel cells is that most people who remember anything about hydrogen remember the Hindenburg, right? It turns out Ford Motor Company did a very large study on the safety of hydrogen in vehicles, thinking it would be bad for business if their fuel cell vehicles were blowing up, and concluded that it's on balance as safe and in many situations actually safer than gasoline and the fuels we're used to. And the reason is that hydrogen is many times lighter than air, so mostly what it wants to do when it gets away is escape. It just dissipates. And is it flammable? You betcha it is. And it has a wide explosive range. But it's almost impossible to make it explode in open air. And if handled correctly, it's, as I say, Ford concluded that it was as safe and in many situations safer than conventional fuels. In fact, the only danger to the public they saw was really worrisome was if hydrogen would be allowed to build up in a home garage with no hydrogen detection and no ventilation in place, and there were a spark, that could be a problem. But in things like tunnel crashes and, you know, you name the scenario, it actually turned out to be as safe and in many situations safer. And you don't think about it much because it happens kind of behind the scenes, but we have a hydrogen economy in a way already. The U.S. produces 9 million tons of hydrogen. It's made and compressed and piped in pipelines. There are about 700 miles of pipelines, mostly in the Gulf Coast. So it's not as if we have no experience, the royal we here, not as if industry has no experience handling it safely. And, I mean, minus the Hindenburg, I defy anyone to think of the last hydrogen accident. So it's actually incredibly safe.
A follow-up, if I may. Is that how it's handled, like an LP gas where you'd have fittings and you have to make sure your fittings are tight before you release it to fill your tank and those kinds of things?
Senator Olsen. That's exactly right. In fact, if we had more time and if I had visuals, it would be fun to show you some of the dispensers. I'm in a couple of weeks, we'll go to the National Hydrogen Association meeting in Texas, which used to be probably about a room this size, and now it's about 1,200 people from all over the world. Instead of filling up like you do today where it goes into the tank and you fill with gasoline, this works just the opposite where there's a coupling and you just twist it. So it's very much like going and getting your gas grill refilled with propane. In fact, several people have talked about, you know, maybe that's a good early niche to get people used to using hydrogen because, you know, people were afraid of light bulbs when they were first introduced, and they were afraid of natural gas. You know, I'm not going to have that piped in my home. And now people think nothing of it, sort of to the consternation of utilities. They can't get people to be quite careful enough with natural gas. So it would work very much in that same way as a compressed gas.
Okay, thank you. Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to address the committee on this bill? Okay, then Senator Anderson moves Senate File 1282 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
That's right.
Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you.
And that being all that is before the committee at this time, the meeting is adjourned.